May it please the court. My name is Tom Nye, and I represent the appellant Valley Regional Medical Center. This is an appeal from a $10.3 million jury verdict following the birth of a minor child by the initials AMA that resulted in tragic brain damage. This is a case of first impression involving the application of the periodic payment statute, and I'll confine my arguments to that issue in two respects. Number one, the trial court had no discretion to find 5 years of periodic payments. The trial court had no discretion to find 5 years of periodic payments. And number two, there's no legal or factual basis for the trial court's $7 million lump sum award and $3 million award in periodic payments.
What was that number, the?
$7 million in lump sum award.
The $7 million lump sum. Okay.
And $3 million in periodic payments over 5 years.
All right.
I'd like to examine these issues respect to the jury's findings, then look at the judgment of the trial court, and then look at the periodic payment statute. I filed this morning with the court a notebook with oral argument exhibits. I'm hopeful that the court has that.
We do.
And if the court wouldn't mind turning to tab one, the court can see that on the left side is the jury's finding on tab one. On the left side is the jury's finding on damages, and on the right side is the court's judgment. The jury found in response to question 3E that there would be health care expenses incurred until the age of 18 in excess of $9 million. The jury found in response to question 3E that the child would incur health care expenses after the age of 18 of over $1.2 million. Okay? One of the problems with this case is that when the trial court entered its judgment, it entered two findings on page 3, and that's on the right-hand side of tab 1. The court found that periodic payments in the amount of $604,000 will compensate the minor child for his future damages. And the court made a second finding. The court finds that there would be five payments beginning at the age of 4 and ending at the age of 8. The problem here is under Rule 301. Rule 301 says that the judgment of the trial court shall, it's mandatory, shall conform to the verdict. The left-hand side of tab 1, the jury's verdict, does not conform to the judgment on the right side. The jury found medical expenses past the age of 18 years of age. However, the trial court in its judgment made the finding reducing the number of payments by over 10 years to only five periodic payments ending at age 8.
But didn't the court have total discretion under the statute to structure the future periodic payments as they wanted to? I mean, as far as I read the statute, it doesn't say anything that says you've got to put X amount. It says you can put a portion or all of the future payments into periodic payments.
Yes, Justice Longoria. Let's turn to tab 2 to answer that question. That is the periodic payment statute. And what the court is referring to is 74503A on the right-hand side, and that the trial court can order that periodic payments be paid in whole or in part, and that is correct, and that's mandatory. And I've highlighted the word order because that's the authority given to the trial court. In subsection C, I've highlighted the word finding. That's the only place where the legislature authorized the trial court to make a finding. The court, again, shall, mandatory, make a specific finding of the dollar amount of periodic payments that will compensate the claimant for future damages. That is very important because that, under the doctrine of last antecedent, that modifies periodic payments. And I think, Justice Longoria, what you're getting to is, doesn't the trial court have discretion to determine the number of payments? Well, that would be in subsection D, D4. The court shall specify. The legislature did not authorize the trial court the authority to make a finding. They could only specify. And that specification has to come from the jury's verdict. We requested a jury issue on the life expectancy of the child. It's undisputed in the record that this child would need medical care for every single year for the remaining years of his life. We requested that issue to be submitted to the jury. It was rejected by the trial court. The jury comes back and makes a finding that health care expenses are going to be needed after the age of 18. And then, despite our request for a jury finding, the trial court then enters its own finding, right?
But doesn't the doesn't in and in itself, by the amount that the jury gives in finding E, in itself assumes a limited finding of life of this child after it reaches the age of 18? Because they award $1.2 million in subsection E, and to me in my head that meant, well, they're not thinking that this child's going to live. I mean, 1 million is not very much when you think of what this child requires in health care. So isn't there an assumption already built in that the jury is trying to decide when they figure out future meds, as they do in any case? Okay, yes, they're going to need future meds, but they're going to need future meds for however the life care plan will say. And the life care plan will show you how long they think that this child or adult will live.
Well, but the analysis is constrained by the jury's wording, the question 3E, because it asked the jury to find health care expenses that will be incurred after he reaches the year of 18. So that implies that there's going to be health care expenses that are needed after the year of 18. And so you cannot reconcile health care needs needed after the age of 18 with the trial court making its own finding that health care expenses are only needed to age 8. That's an attempt to circumvent the statute. The whole purpose of this court's interpretation of the periodic payment statute is to determine legislative intent.
Right.
And on page tab 2 on the left-hand side, section 74506, periodic payments terminate on the death of the recipient. Okay? So the intent of the legislature was to make sure that these periodic payments were incurred by year for the duration of the medical care that was incurred or that was needed, and by the trial court reducing it by some age in excess of 18 down to 5 years or age 8, right? Because the child was 3 at the time of trial. The trial court awarded 5 additional payments. Periodic payments would terminate at age 8. So they are circumvented.
They wouldn't terminate at the time of his death if he unfortunately passes away before the age of 8?
Well, yes, that's true.
Okay.
But the judgment has to conform under Rule 301.
I think that's where I'm losing you, Mr. Knight.
Okay.
So tell me how it's not conforming.
It does not conform with the jury's verdict because on 3E, health care expenses, the jury found will be incurred after age 18. Let me look at it from a slightly different perspective.
But Mr. Knight, when you invoked or when your client requested Chapter 74 to be applied, didn't they request for it to be structured this way despite the verdict?
We requested that the statute be fulfilled in every respect is what our request was, for sure, yes. And so and the trial court failed to do that.
In what respect?
In the respect of, in several respects, in ordering only 5 years of periodic payments and awarding $7 million in a lump sum payment and only $3 million in periodic payments.
And obviously it's a case of first impression, which we've there's nothing we can look at as far as case law that would help us understand that the way you ask us to interpret the statute is the way it should be interpreted.
Well, there are a few cases that are published, but none of them directly address 74503C, and none of them address subsection D. Let me work the court through tab 2, okay, where under subsection 74503A, the court orders that periodic payments be paid in whole or in part, right, in periodic payments. So the periodic payments triggers subsection C, where the court shall make a finding of the dollar amount of periodic payments that will compensate the claimant for future damages, and that's critical. That will compensate the claimant for future damages. Well, how does the statute define future damages? That's on the left-hand side of the page. Future damages means damages that are incurred after the date of judgment. Key word there is incurred. Its ordinary dictionary definition meaning means to become liable or subject to. Well, in looking at question 3D and E, the jury in its question found that the medical expenses would be incurred up to age 18 and incurred after age 18. It's impossible to reconcile health care expenses after the age of 18, where the trial court said, no, I'm going to award all of that up to when the child turns age 8. That's inconsistent, and it's inconsistent with the wording of the statute.
Is the problem with the judgment that the judge used the age 8 as opposed to she would have said 5 periodic payments every 6 months until the amount that the child judge ruled was complied with? Is the age that is throwing us off in this case? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Because Justice Longoria corrects, says it's up to the trial court how many periodic payments and how long they can be or the length of them. So is the age the issue that becomes the problem here?
Well, I think the trial court is constrained by the statute on determining the number of payments or the period of time over which payments are to be made. When we requested a jury issue on life expectancy and we requested a separate issue on the number of payments and the amount per year, and that was rejected, that is error because we're entitled to have a jury decide that issue. Here, the trial court found 5 years after we had requested the jury to do it. That's a denial of our constitutional right to a jury trial. A trial court can't, after the fact, say, well, I'm going to say 5 years and rely on the statute when the statute never authorizes a finding. The statute only authorizes a finding in subsection C, and that is the dollar amount of periodic payments that will compensate the claimant for the future damages. Okay. And the future damages are over $10 million, but in order to circumvent 74506B, they reduced it and gave a $7 million lump sum payment. Here's the problem with what happened. No Rule 30 motion was filed in this case. The plaintiffs rely on contrary evidence in attempt to support the five-year $3 million award. The case law has been for over 50 years. You cannot rely on contrary evidence in order to disregard what the jury has already expressly found. I would also argue to the court that there is no factual or legal basis for the trial court's award of $3 million. Clearly, the jury awarded over $10 million. And there's no legal or factual basis to support the award of $7 million in a lump sum payment because there is no evidence to support that the child would need $7 million in medical expenses or that the child would incur $7 million in medical expenses from the date of the judgment until the first periodic payment. And the trial court abused its discretion in entering findings it did not have the authority to make, and it abused its discretion in entering these findings when there's no evidence to support those findings in the record.
Is there any further questions before? Thank you, Mr. Knack. Appreciate it. Proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Greg White, and I represent AMA Andre and his mother. I want to be clear that the child in this case was born with hypoxic skin, ischemic encephalopathy. Sorry, mouthful. His umbilical cord was wrapped twice around his neck so tightly that the doctor had to cut it away at birth. Almost without fail, the doctors agreed that it was this umbilical cord around his neck and his strangling for an hour while the nurses failed to call the doctor that resulted in these injuries. And there's been no discussion this morning in argument about causation, which was a main point in the brief. And so I'm going to kind of reserve that to the end, but I have the natural lawyer's fear that there is a substantial brief written on this. So I welcome questions about that if they are on the court's mind. But since we began talking about the statute, that's where I will begin. The argument that Columbia is making today is that you should amend the statute and not apply it.
Okay.
What they want you to delete is the words "in part," because 74503(1), the A part that we are talking about, says that the court shall order the payments if they're requested, and the periodic payments shall be made in whole or in part. That clearly gives a trial judge the discretion to decide which portion of the damages found to the jury will be set aside to periodic payments, and the balance can be paid in a lump sum. That's what "in whole or in part" has to mean. There is no clearer words that the legislature could have used that would have granted the judge discretion to do that. Now, why would the legislature allow a judge to take part of the verdict and make it in periodic payments and part of it in a lump sum? That's because judges know things that jurors are not permitted to know. Jurors do not know whether and when a plaintiff like this child will have to make Medicaid reimbursement. Money needs to be available to do that. The judge knows, and the jury does not, that attorney's fees and expenses of litigation will have to be paid. It would be nice, I suppose, for healthcare providers to be able to squeeze the lawyers by saying, "We're going to make your payments be as long as this person is alive and no longer." And then no lawyer would take the case. Because if a plaintiff who was to get 18 years of payments died in an automobile wreck in year two, the lawyer would not get paid. Because that's when payments cease. Judges know those things. Judges also know that the prediction about when the medical payments will be needed is uncertain business at best. And so when this judge set aside money in a special needs trust, it immediately allowed the child to receive payment, receive care when needed, as opposed to only on his birthday when money came in from a periodic payment. The judge made wise decisions about how to treat this unique situation with a child whose future was uncertain at best and whose future could not be predicted with any degree of certainty. And the statute gave her discretion to decide for periodic payments in whole or in part of the verdict. Remarkably, and I guess, you know, worth noting, the next payment, the second payment, would have been due next week on the fifth birthday of this child. The trial judge was not without guiding principles when she made these findings. She had heard all of the trial evidence, and she had held specific hearings directed to how to make this periodic payment plan work for the child. And although she had set aside and said periodic payments will be $3 million and a lump sum payment of $7 million, you will search the record books for all the cases that have dealt with periodic payment cases and find no judge has ever set aside that much money, $3 million, in periodic payments. If you look at the judgment.
So, Mr.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay, Mr. White. And I wanted you to complete your thought, but if I understand Mr. Nye's argument, and as we said, we're all dealing with a brand new statute here, there still has to be a finding made by this jury as to the life expectancy in order for the... I'm not telling you that the court didn't have the ability to do that, but didn't she, and this, as I say she, because yeah. It's a trial judge, Gregones, didn't she have to first, didn't we have to have those factual findings first before we applied the statute? as to the life expectancy of the child in order to ascertain then how she then makes the periodic payments, whether all in a lump sum or all periodic or any then combination?
I think there's one easy answer to that, and that is that the life expectancy concept is mentioned in this statute one time, and it is mentioned in the very last section, section 506, and it says that life expectancy is relevant to a determination of attorney's fees. And so the judge is supposed to look at the periodic payments that the judge has decided to make, order, and make those reduced to present value so that the lawyer is not overpaid in a lump sum in the beginning. Life expectancy is never mentioned anywhere else in the statute. And you can only say that, well, the normal common law treatment of life expectancy in cases in this court and every other is that it is but one factor in determining for the jury what amount of future medical expenses are to be awarded. I will cite you Berry Property Management versus Blakely and Harvey versus Culpepper out of this court, where, and they're not on point with this statute. What they do say, though, is that a determination of future medical expenses is solely based on the reasonable probability that they will be incurred. The things that the jury is entitled to take into account are very common sense. What's the nature of the injury? What progress has the plaintiff made toward recovery? What physical condition is the plaintiff in? What is the necessity and value of any future expenses, and how long will they go on? Jurors have been given that guidance forever. And if you think about all the cases in which future medical might be awarded, there is no reason from this statutory language that legislature has directed that jurors in these kinds of cases and them alone are to make specific findings about life expectancy. I would offer also this kind of common sense problem. Do you really think that a juror could fill in a blank that says, how much money will this child in this case need in 2022 and 23? That granulated issue, of course, is of great benefit to defendants because they are then able to argue to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, there's no way you can predict what this child will need 10 years from now. The plaintiffs have put on no evidence of what the expenses would be in 24. They're merely guessing at it. The judge does not want you to speculate. The only thing you can do in light of the judge's instruction about preponderance of the evidence is put a zero in those blanks. And that's the warning that the Supreme Court gave when it said we're going to stop granulating issues and give jurors broad form submission. They said this granulation tilts the scales towards one side or another and allows them to argue things to get their own benefit from it. And so if you are looking for a reason to require a jury to find life expectancy or to granulate the findings on medical expenses, you will find no such instructions in the statute. If the legislature had demanded that in healthcare liability cases there must be specific jury findings about either life expectancy or the specific amount of medical expenses per year, it surely would not have used this language to make that requirement. So what you are looking at in the argument of Columbia here is not an argument that the statute says the judge must do something that she did not do. You are looking at an argument that says, I wish the statute had said something that I'm asking you to engraft upon it. Instead, the statute does exactly what you would expect a wise decision to be, and is a recognition that every case is different for future medical expenses. Let's take the simple one. A guy has his knees hurt in an automobile wreck, and although they are not healed up now, within the next 5 years, all the orthopedic surgeons say he's going to have to get a knee replacement. And knee replacements are, I'm making this number up, $15,000 a piece. Well, we can say that there will be periodic payments so that there will be $15,000 available in 5 years hence, and we would say the judge would have little reason to deviate from that. But here, The judge's knowledge that this prediction about the future is uncertain, that the child may need more medical care in a particular year than the periodic payments allow. The child will have to make Medicare reimbursement. The child will have to pay attorney's fees, all of which were never presented to the jury, leaves a great amount of discretion with the judge, and wisely so. Had the legislature said, when a defendant elects periodic payments, those payments must be made completely over the life expectancy of a child, that would be a statute where Columbia's argument would make sense. But the legislature granted the judge discretion. They did not put the findings in the hands of the jury. They did not put the election in the hands of the defendant. And I think there's a good reason they didn't do that. In no other kind of case is a defendant, by his own election, allowed to determine how and when he will pay a judgment. Our rule in American courts is that if you are found liable, then you pay. This is a exception. It is a grant. It is a favor to health care liability providers that, but for you, you may pay part of this in periodic payments. The statute does no more than that. I guess that I may be using the wrong word, but I mean, it's just so easy to read the statute the way that I'm suggesting, whole or in part. The judge makes the findings of what is going to be set aside in periodic payments. The judge
did. Well, I agree with you that it's easy to read it that way, but I can, as any interpretation of the statute, again.
As my mind begins.
Right, as yes. My mind begins. But as Mr. Nye was arguing, I can also see that his interpretation of the statute always works. And when we're always dealing with new statutes, we have to go to the legislature intent in order to ascertain what was the purpose of this statute. And so that's where I'm struggling to ascertain which interpretation fits better.
I cited a couple.
Either.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, I cited a couple of cases in the brief, right around page 40 through 48. But I'm going to give you a couple of those now. First of all, and I don't say that this is a command, but as a reminder, the court is not to substitute its view for what should have been written for what has actually been written. That's the Smith Equipment case on page 48. And even if you divine a kind of general purpose of the legislature to protect health care providers because of a health care crisis in Texas or anywhere else, no legislation pursues its purposes at all costs. And that's the Rodriguez case out of the United States Supreme Court that I cited in page 42. A court should not take it upon itself to say, well, this reading would help healthcare providers, and helping healthcare providers has been a purpose of the legislature. Therefore, I must assume that the legislature would use words only to help healthcare providers. You cannot assume that legislation is always leaning in that direction when the plain language doesn't tell you that. And so, although I agree, Justice Benavides, that we often are faced with determining legislative intent from a legislature whose intentions are rarely clear, I still know this. Clear words come first. Plain language comes first. If I can read it and know what it means, I don't need to know what the legislature intended, what their collective mind was. I pause here because I'm waiting to see if there are more ways that I can help the court with that portion, or if there are questions about the causation.
Actually, with regard to causation, are we only looking at the time period, that those minutes by minutes time period, or are we looking at anything that should have been done before to obviously identify that the umbilical cord was wrapped around the neck?
There's no contention that it should have been known sooner.
Okay.
And so we're looking at two things in the causation arguments that's been made by Columbia. One of them is, did we eliminate every other possible reason that the child would have had a brain injury? And we make citations in our brief on pages 26 and 27, and there is a section in the bench book that we provided, tab D, that gives you the actual testimony of people that said, yes, we considered a genetic deficiency, yes, we considered infection or deficiencies in the placenta, we considered all these things, and they were debunked at trial in front of the jury. The other thing, and I think this answers your question better, Judge Perks, is what about the timeline that's here? And one of Columbia's arguments is, well, is it really proven that had Dr. Martinez arrived earlier that the injury would not have occurred? And there is direct evidence on that question. Dr. Martinez himself says, if they had called me sooner, I could have saved this baby. The evidence from experts was that this injury occurred or could have been, if the baby had been delivered at 121 instead of 133, then the oxygen deprivation wouldn't have been, wouldn't have caused this injury. So what you can tell from that is that there is a 37-minute time period that it took Dr. Martinez, the treating OB, to arrive and deliver the baby from the time he got the call. If you put that 37 minutes at 12:05, which is the first thing on the timeline, the first deceleration of the heartbeat, if Dr. Martinez had been called then, the 37 minutes would have beat the 121 deadline. Dr. Martinez said, I expected a call then. 15 minutes later, there was another deceleration. The nurse testimony was that was a dangerous one, and they should have called the doctor. They must call the doctor. They did not. If you added 37 minutes to 12:23, you would have beat the 121 deadline. And that's how that timeline works, if I've made that clear, Judge Perks.
Is part of your contention that there should have been a physician on site as opposed to merely having the nursing and making the phone calls when needed?
That's not in the record, no. Okay. That contention is not made because Dr. Martinez was available. And,
but he was,
you know, to get a little blunt, the mama's water had broken. The baby was going to be born. And so at 12:03, it wasn't, oh, well, is she going to go home tonight and then come back later? It was, when tonight is the baby coming, not is the baby coming tonight? So Dr. Martinez, from his testimony, I'm prepared to come. I would have come if I had been called. If I had been called, I would have saved the baby if they called me earlier.
Are there any questions on the judgment as asserted, I think, about post-judgment interest in the matter of calculation? Is that an issue, or did the parties agree? I think the briefs were at odds on that, and I was just...
There's one thing, and that is that the portion of the periodic payments, approximately $3 million. Can I talk in round numbers like
sure,
that?
Yes.
Okay, so $3 million in periodic payments. Normally that would be reduced to present value.
Right.
But the judge ordered that to be placed in an escrow account and that all the interest from the escrow would belong to Columbia. So there's no present value to calculate then because any earnings on it would have belonged to Columbia. And so that's why we think the judge did it correctly. If by some unfortunate circumstance, the child died before the periodic payments were done, Columbia has gotten the interest from everything it deposited in escrow and gets back anything that was not yet due.
Okay.
Does that answer that question?
That does. And
thank
then
you.
One other question on the judgment.
Yes.
By reference to the trust, it also includes the father who is not a party to the lawsuit, correct?
Well, yes, it does.
And do you have any comment on that?
Yes, it does. Well, it's a child that these are not damages for that and for the father. No, none were asserted. And I think the thought here is that the trustees need to pay for Medicare reimbursement if required.
I
Okay, Mr. Nye, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. Let me start with the in part argument made by opposing counsel in the statute, unless the court has a different starting
That's
point.
That's exactly where I want you to start.
That's okay. A great place.
The plaintiff's position that in part solves the problem is easy to understand, easy to read, easy to implement, but it's inconsistent with the legislative intent. And I would turn the court to tab 4 on statutory construction that I handed in the arguments and in the exhibit notebook. Determining legislative intent requires that we consider the statute as a whole.
But Mr. White is arguing that we don't go there because the statute says what it says. Now, sometimes we know that the legislature writes statutes thinking that the consequences is A and the consequences ends being B, which might be the circumstances, but if they write it this way, do we have to look at the legislature intent if it's clear?
Well, yes, all construction leads to legislative intent. Okay. And the part that I was going to read is you cannot read a statute in isolation. They're taking two words and saying that those two words in part controls the entire statute. And that's not true because they're not giving effect to 74503C, which requires the trial court to find a dollar amount of periodic payments that will compensate the claimant for future damages. The jury's already foreclosed that issue by finding future damages after the age of 18, and there's a legal and factual fiction by the trial court circumventing those jury findings and arbitrarily awarding 5 years and a lump sum payment of $7 million. The problem with that is, under the plaintiff's theory of construction of the statute, whatever the trial court thinks is best is sufficient. Well, then that's an unbridled discretion. You could never appeal what the trial court subjectively thinks is proper or improper. We gave the illustration in our brief. What about five periodic payments of a dollar each and the total amount awarded over $10 million as the lump sum payment? Well, under his theory, if the judge thought, well, you know, it's better off in a special needs trust and the family can use it however they think is best, that would not be an abuse of discretion. Well, the contrary example would also apply here. What happens if you had a different judge who said, I'm going to order $1 in lump sum, 27 payments of a dollar each, and the balance of over $10 million paid in the last periodic payment? Such a construction that anything goes, or whatever the trial court thinks is best, leads to absurd results.
Well, not whatever think the trial court. I think we would still have an abuse of discretion standard, and that is a trial court did something, as you have outlined, on either extreme. There has to be still some a basis of it.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, but based on what? Okay.
Right.
We say it's based on the evidence. They say, no, you don't consider evidence. Take a look at pages 41, 44, and 48 of their brief. Their argument is you don't consider evidence. It's only some confusing discretion standard, whatever the trial court thinks is best. Well, this court has to decide what is the standard that it's going to review the trial court's award of $7 million and the $3 million in periodic payments. We say it has to be based on the evidence. There's absolutely no evidence to support an award of $7 million up front. And there's certainly no evidence of $3 million a year for 5 years. The jury discredited that. All of the expert testimony discredited that. Okay? They want to ignore subsection 74503C, which requires the trial court to make a finding of the periodic payments that will compensate the claimant for future damages. And that is being totally ignored in their brief, totally ignored in oral argument, and they want the court to ignore it as well. And it cannot if it's going to be a proper interpretation of the statute. So I'll get back to what Justice Benavides just got to, and I think that's the linchpin of this case on appeal. How are we going to determine how, when and if a trial court abuses its discretion? Is it going to be based on the evidence or just based on whatever the trial court thinks is best for the family? And that's a critical issue for the court. I would also argue to the court that the interpretation that in part also is read in isolation to the exclusion of section 74506B, which talks about the termination upon death provision. Never discussed in the brief, never discussed in oral argument. If you read the in part as being controlling, then that means the trial court can negate that portion of the statute, which is contrary to the legislative intent. The legislative intent clearly was to reduce health care costs, and that is what is happening when the trial court disregards the jury findings and did not allow us to submit issues to the court. I'll submit to the court one case that we argued in our brief. That's the Cunningham case. A controlling issue is one that requires a factual determination in order for the judgment to be rendered in a case. In order for the trial court to properly effectuate 503D, in other words, the dollar amount of the payments and the number of payments or the period of time over which the payments must be made, we were entitled to have the jury decide that issue. We did not ask for a bench trial. We asked for a jury trial. We submitted it in proper form, we properly objected, and it was refused. And we cannot be denied that constitutional right to a jury trial on those binding and controlling issues in this case.
If we were to agree with you, Mr. Knight, does your analysis lead directly to a modification of the judgment as ultimately what would occur to the judgment in this case, if we were to agree with you?
Part of our argument, yes, is for modification of the judgment. A denial of the right to submit a controlling contested issue entitles us to a new trial. So we're entitled to a new trial when the trial court refused binding controlling issues of fact should have been submitted to the jury. So we're asking for two areas of relief.
So either a new trial or a modification of the judgment.
Exactly.
Okay. Got it.
If the court didn't have any further questions.
Anything further from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Knight. Y'all may be excused.